ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, it's a music show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. What do you think of first when you think of the 1980s? Big hair? Commercial pop hits? Lip-syncing, maybe? Certainly the music video. I think of rap music getting a really firm foothold in popular culture. House music was born. It's Live Aid. We've got Quincy Jones conducting Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan in the United States and Bananarama and U2 singing choruses together in the UK. In Australia, Kylie Minogue, but also Yothu Yindi. And a huge amount of very varied music. Contradictory, much of it. Impossible to sum up, but Tony Wellington has given it a red hot go and he is back on the show to take us through the entire decade in one book, from mixtapes to MTV. Duran Duran, Girls on Film. It's a song that is mentioned very early in this book, Mixtapes and MTV. It's the work of Tony Wellington and it's subtitled Triumphs and Tragedies in 1980s Music. You may remember the last time we spoke to Tony Wellington, it was about 1970s music, his previous book, and I wouldn't mind putting a little bet on what his next book is going to be about. But in the meantime, it's the 80s. Tony Wellington, welcome back to the music show.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Let us talk about this song, Girls on Film, from the point of view of its look, because this is one of the significant moments in pop music, and it's there in your title, Mixtapes and MTV, especially the MTV bit. Why is it significant in terms of MTV?
So this was Duran Duran's first big hit from their debut album. The song is theoretically about the exploitation of women in the fashion business, but, you know, if you listen to the lyrics, it's hard to tell whether it's really concerned about the status of women or simply reveling in their exploitation. Nevertheless, it's significant because when MTV was just 12 days old, the video for Girls on Film was being made, the filmmakers in this case being Lowell Krem and Kevin Godley, ex-10cc, who'd turned themselves into music video makers. And the original video for the song is a kind of, it's almost cheesecake porn, you know. You have the band playing in a makeshift boxing ring come catwalk with semi-naked, almost completely naked women riding men and mud wrestling and hosing each other down. It was actually made for the dance clubs in the UK and they could get away with that sort of stuff. But then MTV arrived and so they had to kind of clean it up up a little bit. They removed, you know, close-ups of ice being rubbed on nipples and that sort of thing. And it became one of the important opening salvos on MTV. But I guess it's also significant because MTV, when it first began in 1981, was incredibly reliant upon British-made music clips. And that's because the British music industry was much more engaged in the making of music videos than the American recording business. At the same time, you had that whole new romantic scene going on in London, which had a very visual focus. So all of these things led to what ended up being called the second British invasion in America. And that became sort of more than just theoretical. It became fact in 1983 when 18 British singles were in the top 40 compared with 1965, you know, after the Beatles started the first British invasion, there were only 14 British singles in the top 40 of the American hit parade.
It's remarkable, isn't it, how there is such a wide range of music in the 1980s, and it sort of comes from the 70s. I mean, it's all happening in the 1970s, you know, the New Romantics, for instance, and the post-punk era, but also reggae, for example, and disco. It's all up and running by the time the 80s starts. Perhaps we should jump straight into another track, and this is very apropos, one of the biggest records ever made. Billie Jean from Michael Jackson's album Thriller from 1982. On today's music show, I'm talking to Tony Wellington, who has written another big fat book about pop music. This one is about the 1980s, and it's called Mixtapes and MTV. Tony, Michael Jackson's fame was absolutely mega, and this album was its zenith, really, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, it's still the biggest selling album of all time, Thriller. No solo artist had sold more than 12 million copies previously, but Thriller managed to sell 30 million in its first year and remained on the top of the charts in America for 2 years and would ultimately end up selling 70 million copies. And, you know, I mean, that's far beyond even the second best-selling album of all time, which is AC/DC's Back in Black. So, yeah, it was a phenomenon. It also helped rescue a music industry that was in a slump at the time, because between 1978 and 1982, American record labels only released half the number of new releases they had prior to that. In the first half of the 1980s, record labels were shedding staff at a rapid rate. CBS got rid of 7,000 staff. So things were looking pretty poorly. And along came Michael Jackson. Walter Yetnikoff really threw money at this album. I mean, it cost $750,000 to make, which was a lot in 1982. And on top of that, Yetnikoff also spent $100,000 on each single paying pluggers. Now, this was the whole payola thing that was supposed to be illegal. It had been made illegal in the 1950s and 1960s to pay radio stations to play songs. So Yetnikoff and other labels got around that by paying intermediaries who would then go and organise, you know, the graft, as it were, to get songs played. So there was a lot behind it, but it was also a massive PR push, to the extent that the making of documentary for the track Thriller became the third biggest selling video VHS of the year, behind Jane Fonda's Workout and Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was an international phenomenon.
But a lot of people, I imagine, were working out to the tracks off this album anyway. But, I mean, you can't think of Thriller without having an image in your mind, can you? It's as much visual as it is oral.
That's right. And there was a massive amount of hype to the lead up of the release of the video. And the video for Thriller in particular, I mean, Billie Jean established Michael as an incredible dancer on screen. But when they decided to make a video for Thriller, they engaged John Landis, who'd made American Werewolf in London, and he kind of made a mini version of that film. And it became a 14-minute drama. And that absolutely raised the stakes for what music videos could do. It went way beyond the tradition of music videos being artists miming to one of their songs. And instead, it even had credits for the crew on the screen. So suddenly there was large sums of money involved in making music videos, and the production values just really stepped up.
And the production values in the music too, we have to mention Quincy Jones.
Yes. I mean, Quincy Jones is the reason, really, that Thriller was so successful. We have to remember that Michael Jackson couldn't read or write music. So when he composed a song, it was entirely in his head, and he'd go in and he'd sing it to Quincy and his team, and Quincy or one of his team would have to try and work out the notation, then they'd work out the arrangement. It was Quincy that decided pretty much which songs would go on the album. It was Quincy that decided which members of the session crew were going to perform. It was very much a Quincy Jones album as much as a Michael Jackson album. But the irony is, Michael Jackson was somewhat resentful of Quincy Jones' influence over the Thriller album, and he actually asked Walter Yetnikoff from CBS Records if Walter could prevent Quincy Jones from receiving any Grammy Awards, but Walter Yetnikoff had to explain he didn't have that much power.
No, not quite. MTV is very important here as well, isn't it?
Yes, and MTV finished up, in fact, in Australia, and will conclude in the UK and Europe come the end of the year. It will continue with its entertainment shows, but in terms of the sort of music shows that it began with, they're concluding, and that's very much because Paramount is now looking to try and consolidate its expenses.
David Bowie put out an album in 1983, which was not universally admired, Let's Dance. Let's have a listen. Another song with a great video.
That's right. He was living in Sydney at the time, and the video was made in Australia. And the video challenged attitudes to First Nations people. It began in a pub where there are sideways glances to a young Aboriginal couple in the pub. And Bowie explained to the world that in many Australian pubs, the First Nations people couldn't buy drinks in the front bar. They had to go round to the back. But then it went on to show a young couple buying jewellery with Amex and dining at a very fancy-looking restaurant. And in doing so, he was challenging the audience assumptions about what was appropriate for First Nations people. The extraordinary thing is that the song Let's Dance has nothing to do with race relations. It's a poppy little dance song about dancing and nothing much else. So it shows the capacity, really, of music videos and MTV to inject subtext into songs that really didn't have the subtext to begin with.
Bye. One of the things I enjoyed most about your book, Tony, was your periodic attempts to explain music videos and what they were meant to be about.
Yeah, look, it's sometimes a struggle. Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer was a landmark video too. Visually, it was just extraordinary, but no one can explain what the song's about. There are some suggestions that it might have phallic symbolism, but the video set another new standard for music videos and again had very little to do with the subject matter of the song.
We'll come back to videos and we'll come back to Australian pubs actually in a moment. But just a word about this album of Bowie's, because I'm one of those people who loves it. And one of the reasons I love it is I love his voice on this album. I love that you can hear it really in all its glory because he's just singing songs.
And I think that comes down to the influence of Nile Rodgers, who was the producer on the album. Now, Rodgers hadn't had a hit for a couple of years, which he said felt like an eternity. But once Let's Dance took off, he'd be all over 80s music after that, producing works for Madonna and songs for INXS and you name it. But it goes to the fact that producers, and we've talked about Quincy Jones as well, but others like Hugh Padgham, Trevor Horn, Mutt Lange, these were really important and influential in the 80s in a way that producers to some extent hadn't been previously. And that again goes to the fact that the music industry was struggling, and so the music labels were appointing producers to artists, and the producers became kind of an insurance policy to getting hits out of them. And if you say run, I'll run with you.
And if you say hide, we'll hide. Because my love for you would break. I mentioned Australian pubs, and Down Under from Men at Work is a good example of music which really comes from a band that started in Australian pubs, Tony.
Well, there was a thriving pub rock scene in the early 80s in Australia, and it was thriving basically because it was unregulated. They were putting thousands of punters into venues that should really only have been holding a couple of hundred. And that meant that the pub rock scene became a proving ground for all sorts of bands, not just Men at Work, but Australian Crawl, Midnight Oil, INXS, Cold Chisel, Divinyls, etc. And many of them, having proven their success through the pub rock scene in Australia, then looked to America to try and make it big, following in the footsteps of people like Olivia Newton-John and Little River Band. So when Men at Work did their first album, Down Under was the big hit. It was presented to their label in America, CBS, and CBS couldn't hear a hit song on it. They didn't like the album at all, and they prevaricated about releasing it. When they did release it, it became the biggest selling debut album in America since the Monkees in the 60s. An album that cost $30,000 to make ended up selling more than 10 million copies. He said, I've come from a land down under. There's that quote from the Washington Post in your book that Australia is the Liverpool of the 1980s. Yeah, that quote came from 1982, at this very moment when so many Australian pub rock bands were looking to America and many of them were travelling there. So that would be the undoing of a great many of them, including Cold Chisel and Divinyls, trying to make it into America and realising how difficult that process really was.
Yes. Down Under was also very big amongst expats for obvious reasons.
Well, I mean, this is why I love Men at Work, and not just for that song, but they were irreverent and they actually sold Australian larrikinism to the world. Their music videos were really silly, even hopping up and down pretending to be kangaroos on the Cronulla sand dunes. And that previous artists like Olivia Newton-John and Ayers Rock and Little River Band became sort of faux transatlantic Americans, whereas Men at Work were proudly Australian, and when they toured, they made sure that they took Australian acts as support acts. They were wonderful to the other Australian acts that were trying to make it big, but they were also unashamedly Australian, and that hadn't really happened before.
There's a point of contact, though, I think, musically between Men at Work and the Police. The influence of reggae is there for both of them. And also Colin Hay's voice and Sting's voice both seem to have almost like a kind of Jamaican twang. And it's actually Scottish in Colin Hay's voice and Geordie in Sting's case. But many of those vowel sounds are remarkably similar.
Sting was riding high at the same time the Police were going gangbusters, but the band quickly fell apart and Sting became a huge solo artist.
Speaking of huge solo artists, we will get to Sting in due course, but none huger than Madonna. Today's music show, we're talking about the music of the 1980s with Tony Wellington, who's the author of Mixtapes and MTV. That's almost the quintessential 1980s song, Tony.
Yes, and it was her first number one hit. One of the key things about the 1980s is that solo women artists became far more assertive. They could use MTV to express their independence and their sexuality, as Madonna was terribly good at. If you remember, Like a Virgin's album had her wearing her underwear as outerwear, you know, that bustier top with the belt buckle that said boy toy, which scandalised many. The song itself was written by a couple of blokes, Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly, and they didn't write it for Madonna. They didn't write it for anyone in particular, but it was Madonna's label that decided it would be perfect for her. And by producing a somewhat raunchy music video, it turned into a scandalous song, because the song's really just about, you know, enjoying the flush of first love. But she also went on to perform live on the very first MTV Music Awards, where Bette Midler introduced her as the woman who pulled herself up by her bra straps. And Madonna gave a performance that absolutely scandalised. Again, in the bustier top with a wedding veil, she came down the steps and writhed around in sexual ecstasy and absolutely scandalised, but that was exactly what she was aiming to do, and as a result of which, Madonna went from being a nobody in the beginning of the 80s to the highest paid female entertainer on the planet by 1989.
Yes, it's an incredible rise, isn't it?
It's extraordinary.
Let's move on to loftier things. We Are the World, USA for Africa.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one. There are people dying, oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life, the greatest gift of all.
We can't go on pretending day by day that someone somewhere will soon make a change.
We are all a part of God's great big family.
And the truth, you know, love is all we need.
We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make a brighter day. So let's start giving. It's true, we make a better day, just you and me.
Now, charity rock became a thing in the 1980s, Tony.
Like never before, yeah. I mean, it had a predecessor or two, like George Harrison's Concert for Bangladesh. But the charity rock phenomenon took off when Bob Geldof saw a documentary about the plight of people in Ethiopia. He made the 1984 Christmas single, Do They Know It's Christmas, with a whole bunch of British artists, and it became the fastest-selling single in UK history. On the back of that, over in America, Harry Belafonte decided that they should be doing something to help. So he approached music manager Ken Cragen with the idea of doing a similar single there, and they got Quincy Jones in to produce. They couldn't get in touch with Stevie Wonder, so they asked Michael Jackson. So Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie ended up writing the tune We Are The World. 44 artists were recorded. They had to keep the location secret so it didn't get overrun by paparazzi and fans. And they decided cleverly to record it on the night of the American Music Awards, when most of the artists would be in town. And it turned into a huge hit. It went to number one right across the world, raised $63 million, which, you know, is about $170 million today for humanitarian causes. But it didn't entirely please everyone. One of my favourite lines is from Jackson Browne, who said, the problem is that America thinks they are the world.
Yes, doubtless you've seen the documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop.
Of course, yes.
Yes. I should recommend that to our listeners, not least for Stevie Wonder teaching Bob Dylan how to sing like Bob Dylan.
Yeah, and Bob Dylan was really flummoxed.
There's a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. It's true, we make a better day. Just you and me.
We are the world.
But everyone was nervous in the recording session because they weren't used to working in front of their peers, you know. They were used to having recording sessions on their own. So, you know, there was a good deal of nervousness. The thing about charity rock was that it not only attempted to improve the public perception of music artists who were seen as being, you know, somewhat self-indulgent and decadent, but also it ran counter to the prevailing political thinking at the time, which was, you know, really neoconservative. This was the era when Margaret Thatcher said there's no such thing as society, there are only individual men and women and families. So in a way, the charity rock thing was rock musicians saying, well, we actually don't abide by that degree of selfishness. The people in Ethiopia have an equivalence to ourselves. And that was a pretty radical thing to say. The great quote from Diana Ross, who was interviewed at the end of the session for We Are The World, and she said, I've got a feeling that we're creating a shift in what's going on the planet. It's called compassion, it's real new. So it probably was the first time she'd thought about anyone but herself.
There's a lovely quote in the book from Rolling Stone this time, suggesting that this has been the first rock and roll decade without a revolution or true revolutionaries to call its own. This was in 1989, by the way. What do you think about that? They're talking about musical revolutionaries, obviously, but is that true?
Well, certainly the 80s spawned a degree of, protest music, most particularly rap music, which became the new form of protest music because black artists tended to aim for crossover music to get a broader white audience, and that left a vacuum that was filled by rap. But the 80s also spawned a whole bunch of somewhat revolutionary genres. I mean, this was the golden age of heavy metal. House music was revolutionary. Alt country was revolutionary. But it wasn't as coalesced like the youth movement of the 60s and early 70s. There wasn't a uniformity to the protest, but there were protest songs, particularly with regard to the Cold War, which really preyed on everyone's minds at the time.
We'll come back to a few of those, but let's just do a little detour into a song about revolution, talking about a revolution. This is Tracy Chapman.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, 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 run? Oh, I said you better run, run.
Tracy Chapman put out her first album in 1988, and that was the second single from the album. What did you think of this at the time, and what do you make of it now, Tony Wellington?
Look, Tracy Chapman was a phenomenon. I mean, that album sold more than 20 million copies worldwide, which is pretty phenomenal. She came out of nowhere. Initially, no one wanted to produce the album because no one had heard of her. And she was a very private person. She wasn't like Madonna, where she kind of fabricated a past and broadcast it. That privacy led to her not being an ongoing success in the same way that her first album was. But she was very much a committed artist. So, like, she joined the Human Rights Now tour that occurred to promote Amnesty International, for example. So she wore her heart on her sleeve, that's for sure.
I started to turn, talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no.
I remember at the time a quote from, I think it was Lyndon Barber, who said that he didn't think that the song made people talk about a revolution. He thought it made them talk about throwing another dinner party.
That says a lot about the times too, because there wasn't really a concerted revolutionary movement, except there was behind the Iron Curtain. This is the height of the Cold War, and by 1989, the Berlin Wall had fallen, and a lot of those satellite countries attached to the Soviet Union were busy separating. So that was as big a revolution as one could expect to see. It just wasn't occurring in Western cultures.
Yes. Maybe this is the moment to talk about Sting and Russians.
In Europe and America, there's a growing feeling of hysteria, conditioned to respond to all the threats and the rhetorical speeches of the Soviet. Mr. Khrushchev said we will bury you. I don't subscribe to this point of view. It would be such an ignorant thing to do if the Russians love their children too. How can I save my life?
That's from Sting's first solo album, The Dream of the Blue Turtles, and his song Russians, with a little help from Sergei Prokofiev there. Is this a serious protest song or what, Tony Wellington?
I think Sting was very serious about protesting too. His private life might have been in a mess, but again, like Tracy Chapman, he joined the Amnesty International tours, wore his heart on his sleeve. You know, in the 1980s, there were 55,000 nuclear warheads deployed on the planet by America and the Soviet Union, and that weighed heavily on everyone's minds. In fact, in 1983, there was a NATO exercise that was viewed by the Soviet Union as America and its allies beginning an invasion and a war on the Soviet Union, and so Russia began loading nuclear warheads onto combat planes as a response to what was simply a NATO exercise. I mean, that's how close the planet came to oblivion, and the whole mutually assured destruction thing was prevalent at the time, which meant that as soon as a nuclear war began, the entire planet was going to be decimated. There was no way around it. And on top of that, you had the AIDS epidemic happening. You had massive unemployment. The UK experienced unemployment at a level not seen since the Great Depression. Grace Jones put it well at the time. She said, the enjoy life spirit of the 1970s in the 1980s became enjoy life while you can.
On today's music show, we're talking about the music of the 1980s with Tony Wellington, who's the author of Mixtapes and MTV. We'll get back to dancing in a moment because obviously that was needed more than ever. But let's just take a quick detour into technology. Mixtapes and MTV, mixtapes sort of speak for themselves and very much came into their own during this decade. But the other thing that happened was the birth of the CD. In some ways, this was part of the salvation of a music industry that, as you said, was in trouble early in the decade.
Absolutely, because the CD was being sold at an incredibly inflated price. It cost about $2 US to make one, and they were selling them for double digits. There was also this push to get people to buy what they had on LP on CD so they could have cleaner versions of their LPs. So there was a lot of doubling up going on, and the music industry went from famine to feast. By the end of the 1980s, the music business was absolutely rolling in money because they were selling LPs, cassettes, and CDs. People were buying CDs of things they'd bought 10, 15 years before. And at the same time, there was a lot of consolidation within the entertainment business. So the large music record labels were buying up little labels like Virgin and Island and consolidating them into these international entertainment businesses.
Because music is happening in the 1980s on such a global scale, it becomes ever more important to have local music as well.
I want to see all the ladies out there shaking that onion. Yeah, shake it, baby.
Is where house music comes in, Tony.
Yeah, house music's really interesting. In a way, I align house music with punk in the 70s and skiffle in the late 50s and early 60s. Each of these three movements kind of operated outside of the mainstream music business at first. Sure, Lonnie Donegan was within the music business for skiffle, and plenty of punk bands ended up in the mainstream, and the same happened ultimately with house music. But house music began out of a need, and that need was related to dance clubs that were feeding their customers with ecstasy or MDMA. And that was because the hug drug, as it was known, wasn't actually illegal at first in the 1980s. So the Stark Club in Dallas, for example, in 1984 was selling ecstasy over the counter, and people were flocking to Texas to experience this. The term house comes from a Chicago club named Warehouse, and house music became, again, a kind of a music that could be made outside of the music business because it could be made in a home studio. And the godfather, if you like, of house music was a Chicago postal worker, Marshall Jefferson, went to a club called the Music Box and was absolutely staggered by the fact that the bass made him shift his body back a couple of feet, and that 120 to 130 beat per second with the bass kick drum hitting every beat just blew him away. So he went and got a loan and got himself some equipment, a sequencer, a drum machine, a mixer, and within 30 minutes of mastering his equipment, had a track put together called Move Your Body. He took it back to the music club on a cassette. They played it six times in a row and the crowd went wild, and house music was kind of born.
Marshall Jefferson, Move Your Body, on The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm talking to Tony Wellington, whose latest book is about the music of the 1980s. It's called Mixtapes and MTV. You mentioned rap a little while ago. Rap was, in a way, a bit like house music. It was on the outskirts of the mainstream, but it joined the mainstream in the 1980s, didn't it?
It did. It was a gradual process. One of the key artists that helped introduce rap to the mainstream was Run DMC. Run DMC were being produced by Rick Rubin from Def Jam Records, who was in fact a white Jewish boy who fell in love with rap music, and he produced some really seminal albums. He influenced Run DMC on their first album to add some hard rock guitar, and then when they were recording their next album, he introduced them to an Aerosmith song called Walk This Way. That song had been a hit for Aerosmith in 1975. They didn't like it, but he convinced them that he could do something with it. Rick Rubin invited a couple of members of Aerosmith to join in the studio recording of their song, which was a kind of hybrid rap heavy metal song, Walk This Way. And it was really audacious. Once it was recorded, Run DMC hated it. They said they didn't want it released as a single. But when it was released in a single, suddenly it was being played on radio right across America. They made a music video, which was very clever, where Aerosmith were playing on one side of a rehearsal wall and Run DMC are on the other side of the wall, and they get frustrated with the bleed through going through the wall of each rehearsal. So Aerosmith bust through the wall and find themselves on a stage with Run DMC in front of an audience of black and white people. It became a huge hit on MTV, and it was the first rap single to reach the top five on Billboard, and it really propelled rap music into mainstream. In fact, in 1986, the European MTV had the first rap music show on MTV, which was then imitated back in America shortly afterwards. So America was resistant at first. In fact, it was quite audacious. Run DMC's first album was called King of Rock, and rap music wasn't even considered rock music at the time. So that was an audacious start too.
I'm assuming you are writing the book on the 90s at the moment, because if you are, then rap is going to be the main story.
Yes, grunge and rap are really the main story in the 90s, but also the increased control that the music industry had over artists. The corporatization of the music industry is very much a product of the 90s too.
I don't think there is any more thrilling opening moment in an album than The Boy in the Bubble at the beginning of Paul Simon's Graceland. Bubble came out in 1986, that album, and that's a brand new sound which we're going to hear a lot more of in the years to come, Tony Wellington.
Yes, this is the album that really introduces world music to Western ears. It was an important defining moment, but it was also a lightning rod for all sorts of debates around the musical appropriation and cultural imperialism, because at the time there was apartheid going on in South Africa, and the United Nations General Assembly had passed a resolution calling for artists and musicians to boycott South Africa. In spite of that, Paul Simon went to South Africa to record. And he did that on the basis of a cassette that he'd been given by a musician by the name of Heidi Berg, which had Boyoyo Boys playing some Makwanga African music, and he fell in love with it. So he went to South Africa without an idea in his head. He got various artists to come into the studio and jam with him. And when he liked something, he would then work on it with them and turn it into a song. And the African artists got credit for it. However, he immediately found himself on the list of people who had breached the United Nations blockage on South Africa, and that caused an enormous furor at the same time as Graceland became top of the charts in Australia, Canada, the UK, and hit number three in the US. So he was copping this opprobrium for what he was doing, but at the same time, he was being celebrated for this breakthrough album.
Yes, and celebrated in Africa as well.
Very much so, because he not only gave credit to the African musicians, he also took them on tour with him, and finally he ended up, somewhat begrudgingly perhaps, giving some of the finances he received as a result of Graceland to various causes in South Africa.
These are the days of miracle and wonder, and don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry.
Paul Simon is a fantastic musician, but he always struggled with sort of writer's block, if you like. And so there had been instances in the past where he'd plagiarised other people's work and taken it for himself. And indeed, on Graceland, whilst he gave credit to the South African artists, there are a couple of tracks on there, one with Los Lobos and another one where he used a band called Rockandopsy and the Twisters, where he actually appropriated their music and didn't give them any credit at all. And they weren't happy about it one bit.
plagiarism aside, it's a remarkable thing that he seems to have found his way into lyrics from the music. And the music, the Cajun music, say, or the South African music, may have absolutely nothing obvious to do with the lyrics, rather like those MTV videos that you were trying to explain. But for him, it was the inspiration for a whole new story about the girl in New York City who calls herself the human trampoline or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And that great song, You Can Call Me Al, which is really about him attending a party and having his name mistaken for Al and his wife's name mistaken for Betty, with a wonderful music video, I have to say, with Chevy Chase, and Chevy Chase miming to Paul Simon's words and Paul Simon being the second fiddle to the comic. And it's a very, very funny video. But you're right that the lyrics didn't really have anything to do with the style of the music. And that indeed led to people like, you know, Jerry Dammers from The Specials saying that he's doing more harm than good because he's not addressing the issue of apartheid whilst he's working with South African artists.
It was actually the composer and conductor Pierre Boulez who came up with the Call Me Al, because it was Paul Simon's own party that Boulez, who was then chief conductor of the New York Philharmonic, was taken to. Boulez didn't know Paul Simon from a bar of soap. And at the end of the party, he said, "Thank you very much, Al, and give my regards to Betty."
To Betty.
They remembered it.
It's a lovely anecdote, isn't it?
It's a lovely, lovely story, yes. I Should Be So Lucky is where we're going to end, and we have to talk about the hit factory. You were mentioning the fact that in the 1990s, everything was much more controlled. Is this the beginning of it?
Well, it's not the beginning, but it's a certain high point, because Stock Aitken Waterman, otherwise known as Saw, were running a hit factory in the late 80s in London, where they seemed to be able to have a bit of a golden touch and churn out song after song. So we talked about the fact that the pub rock scene produced a lot of international Australian artists in the early part of the 80s. By the time there were constraints placed on the pub rock scene, there's a second phase of Australian artists, which is solo artists, and we're talking here about Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan and others. And they were very much manufactured artists in a way at first, because Kylie Minogue was a soap opera star. Neighbours was doing very well in England. She happened to sing a song, The Locomotion, at a fundraiser for a football club, and it was suddenly realised that she could sing. One of Michael Gudinski of Mushroom Records staffers convinced Gudinski to sign her. The Locomotion went to number one. Then they sent her over to London to Saw, to Stock Aitken Waterman, to record a follow-up single, which happened to be I Should Be So Lucky. The problem was that the arrangement had made with Waterman, he wasn't in town. She spent a week in London twiddling her thumbs, and just before she was due to get on the plane, Waterman finally rang Aitken and Stock and said, "You've got to record a song with Kylie Minogue, even though you don't know who she is." So they sent her to the studio, and she sat outside literally while they wrote the song in an hour, then brought her in. She recorded her voice to a rough click trap. She never heard the polished version, and it became the fastest selling single of the year, which then became the Kylie album, which is the biggest selling album of the year, and then Jason Donovan's debut album would be the biggest selling album of 1989. But the word lucky gets repeated 65 times in the one song, and I'm sorry to listeners who are going to be brainwashed with that song now.
They are, I'm afraid. Tony Wellington, it's been an absolute pleasure doing the 1980s for you. Come back and do the 1990s when you're good and ready, and thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much for having me, Andrew.
Mixtapes and MTV, Triumphs and Tragedies in 1980s Music by Tony Wellington, is out now. And that's it for the show. But before we go, I have to say that the music show is having a baby. We haven't had a baby for years. I think the last time was 15 years ago, and that was mine. This one is going to be Ellie Parnell's, though both C. Benedict and I feel as though we have a stake in it. We're very much looking forward to meeting the child when it arrives, but Ellie's going off now to be a different kind of producer. Technical production on the music show this week from Simon Branthwaite and Hamish Camilleri, and we're all of us on Gadigal land. Coming up on the music show, 100 years of the Italian composer Luciano Berio and the characters behind Handel's Messiah.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.